Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode, featuring Dr. Mark Kligman. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of the Sounding Jewish podcast. It is an absolute pleasure to finally be speaking with you, and I'd love to give you the chance to introduce yourself.
Sure, it's a pleasure to be here, Samantha. My name is Mark Kligman. I am the Mickey Katz Endowed Chair in Jewish Music at the UCLA Herb Alpert School of Music, where I am a professor of ethnomusicology, musicology, and the humanities. And I also direct the Lowell Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience.
Wonderful. Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish sound or music and why this was such a formative experience for you? And in particular, what kinds of personal or musical experiences motivated you to want to study Jewish music?
Yeah, so there are two primary stories, and I love telling them. The first one is when I was very young, probably 4 or 5 years old, I remember going to High Holy Day services. And at the time, the synagogue that my family's been a part of where I was bar mitzvah is Temple Ramat Zion in Northridge. And it was being built. So there was a place nearby called Devonshire Downs, which is a big outdoor tent, like a circus tent. And then they had temporary quarters, and that's what they did. And I remember coming into this vast space. I was holding my grandfather's hand. And I came in, and this place just seemed so overwhelming. The sound was just so enveloping and powerful. And I really didn't understand what it was. But what was important to me is that my parents were singing in the choir. So I felt that I had a connection to this entire experience. And pretty much all my years growing up, my grandparents always took us to synagogue because our parents were singing in the choir. And a lot of the time it was me and my siblings being shushed by my grandparents and other people. But I just look so fondly at those experiences. And I'm just so grateful that I grew up at a time period in the synagogue I did that really was largely more traditional conservative. So that was really quite formative. I also remember from my bar mitzvah, you know, I did everything you could do. I read Torah, I davened. To me, it was an incredible experience. And I remember the letdown afterwards and just feeling like, you know, I still was involved in the synagogue by being like a Torah tutor and things like that. And then it just didn't seem to be enough. So I just kind of walked away from it because it was kind of like nothing compared to that really great experience. And then, you know, I kind of just really devoted myself to music, you know, marching band in high school, which was very formative. And when I was in college and decided to become a music major, this would be the second big influence. I was a music theory major, and I was around other theorists and composition students, mainly in my courses. And I remember many of the composition students who are from South America or Japan or other places in Europe were really connected to their culture's music. Everything they did was like not only through that lens, but a way to contribute to that. And I was thinking to myself, what culture do I have? You know, what culture really is a part of me? And I don't know why it took that experience, but it just was that experience that I said, oh, yeah, there's Judaism, you know, very much a part of. And around that time, I remember reading Donald J. Grout's History of Western Music. And in my day in the early 80s, it was the third edition. I think they're up to many more editions at this point. And I remember that there is just like one paragraph about music in the temple. There's music of the Greeks, then there's Gregorian chant, and just one thing about music in the temple. And I thought to myself, there's more of this story here. That just doesn't seem right. So as a music theory major, I had to write a thesis, and I wrote my thesis on what are called the ekphonetic accents or the ta'amim in the Jewish tradition. And I compared it to the diacritical and other similar marks in Syriac chant, as well as Byzantine manuscripts. And it was a really incredible endeavor just to see how scholarship works. And going to, I think, a state school may not have the most fully academic library like other institutions. And I remember I had to get a special pass to go to UCLA to use their library. And I couldn't get enough of this. And I was just so entranced by it. And after I completed my undergraduate thesis, there was an oral defense. And then all my professors there just said, you have to go to graduate school. And, you know, that was kind of my intent anyways. So that period of time in my life when I was really searching not only for where I would put myself in the music profession, but where I was Jewishly as well, is very much a part of my experience. And around that time, I'd gone to something called the Brandeis Bardeen Institute. It was a Jewish collegiate leadership program for the summer. And I always thought I grew up in a fairly Jewish home. You know, we had two sets of dishes during the year, two sets of dishes for Passover. And as I learned at Brandeis, I really didn't know what I didn't know in terms of Jewish texts and many other aspects of the Jewish tradition. And around that time, I met my wife, who was already part of the modern Orthodox community. And I started learning at Yeshiva University of Los Angeles. And just really, it's like a fish taking to water, so to speak. I just really loved that environment. I just loved the learning, the camaraderie, the singing. And then you really wanted to find a way to infuse my Jewish experiences with music. And I wasn't sure where it would go.
Yedi nefesh
And it's so interesting now that my wife and I live back in Northridge, and sometimes we walk through the Cal State Northridge campus. And as we walked on that campus nearly 40 years ago, as a young couple about to get married, planning their lives, I'm so grateful that I've been able to do so many incredible things that I didn't even know existed. But I think I had a really good start of really being inquisitive and people guiding me in different directions.
That's a very special series of stories. Can you tell me more about that movement from heading into yeshiva and realizing there were all these areas you didn't know about to deciding you were going to go to graduate school and pursue what you did?
Yeah, that was a really interesting time. I graduated a year before my wife, and we were married at that point. So I couldn't go to graduate school until she finished undergraduate school. And at that time, I just thought, well, music theory is the way to go. I have an undergraduate degree in music theory. And I went to the University of Michigan program in music theory. And at the time, it was really one of the best programs. We had a lot of very young, notable faculty. And as I was a part of it, I just realized that Schenkerian analysis and set theory, for as wonderful as it is, it just wasn't for me. And I was really looking for something else. And my wife and I, we were young, we didn't have any children. And we were very much a part of the religious community in Detroit, Michigan, in Oak Park and Southfield. And that led us to learning at other times during the year in the summer and December. And I remember going to a yeshiva called Or Sameach. And there I sort of began this aspect of my life is how am I going to reconcile this desire for learning and this desire to be in graduate school? And inherently, there doesn't have to be a conflict, but there becomes a conflict when the Rebbeim you're with, who for all good intention want to steer you in the right direction, really want you to question your beliefs and question a lot of the secular ideology that you have. And I just walked into it feeling like I didn't feel the conflict. I felt that I could harmonize those things. And it may not be that the rabbis at the time felt that I made the right decision in terms of the influence that they wanted to have, but I really knew that there was something that I could do. And I'll never forget that I spent a Shabbos in yeshiva. I think this was before my wife and I were married. And I remember her picking me up from the yeshiva after Saturday night. And usually they called it an in Shabbos when you were just being the yeshiva. And then we had tickets to go see the Berio St. Matthew Passion. And I had studied the work and heard a recording, but to hear it live was such a special opportunity. And I walked out feeling like what a moving experience that was, what a spiritual experience was, even though it wasn't Judaism. And I just sort of felt that I really could harmonize those things. And maybe it was a wing and a prayer, so to speak, but that's how I really pursued it. And then as I was in my doctoral studies at NYU, we lived in Brooklyn in Flatbush, very Orthodox community. And I met some rabbis who basically said, you can make it work if you separate between what your religious life is and what your professional life's going to be. And that was sort of the modality that I took at that time that, I lived in one place and worked in another place. And sometimes there would be conflicts. I mean, I'll never forget at New York University, first year musicology, ethnomusicology students take this intro to musicology class with Stanley Borman. And it was basically he gave you an assignment. And in that assignment, you had to do as much as you could between that Wednesday and the next Monday when you got the work done. And I had Shabbos in there. What was I going to do that my colleagues have 5 full days and I kind of only have 4? But I learned that that made me more productive. It made me more focused in terms of what I could do. And I just dealt with those conflicts in different ways. And it's sometimes, remember one anthropology class I took at NYU. And it was somewhat like this year, where like in the first month of class, I'm missing 3 weeks in a row because the class meets once a week on a Wednesday. And I remember getting feedback from one of my anthropology professors saying, "You're definitely on the right track, but you need more work." And yeah, she was right. I really didn't have all the time that I potentially should have had, but I don't think it stunted my career. But I've just learned how to deal with those conflicts. And then in 1994, when I started at Hebrew Union College, it really put me down a very different trajectory. It's sort of an amazing journey for me that before I became Orthodox in college, I was a music director at Reform and Reconstruction of Synagogues. And I knew that when I would become Shomer Shabbat, I'd have to leave that behind. And that was a very difficult thing. I always sort of felt after that, every high holidays, when I know how beautiful the music is, the music really speaks to me on so many levels based on the story I originally told you. But I just knew that that was something I couldn't do. I couldn't like live in the Orthodox community and direct a choir on the holidays or Shabbat. Now, ironically, in my life here in Los Angeles, there is a male choir that's Orthodox that we don't perform enough, but I get a real boost when I do that. But when I was at Hebrew Union College, it was a really interesting irony in my life at the time that I was basically educating students in a world that I had walked out of. And it took me a number of years to really find a path and really reconcile that. And I have tremendous admiration for all my colleagues at Hebrew Union College and the rabbis and the leadership there, who were so committed to devoting their Jewish life to helping the students learn. And I just decided, well, I have a perspective on Judaism, and I'll just teach that perspective. And it's not the Reform perspective, but I learned a lot about the Reform movement and the history of Reform, which I had no real exposure to prior to being at Hebrew Union College. And it just really broadened me. And for a long time, I kind of said, you know, my life was, I grew up conservative, I became Orthodox, and I teach at a Reform seminary. To add to that, I have an older sister that's Lubavitch, another sister that goes to a Reconstruction in the synagogue. My brother's Reform, my parents remain conservative. So that sense of plurality was sort of always a part of my life in different ways. And I think that Hebrew Union College really help me understand that I don't really need to make those distinctions, that those boundaries really weren't so clear. And what really motivates me is in the work that I do, I just love the Hebrew language. I just love figuring out tefillah or Jewish prayer in Hebrew and what makes it work from all the levels of the history of the liturgy, you know, the music influences, its context. So for me, it's just a way to spend my time. It's like the hobby and passion is the work, which is just incredible.
Can you just tell me about your time in graduate school? On the day-to-day level, what was your time like at NYU? Were there any classes that were particularly memorable? And how did you ultimately arrive at the research topic that formed the basis of your dissertation there?
I'm really grateful that I had the experience I had at NYU in the music department. I had so many influential faculty. I came to study with Kay Kaufman Chalamet, and the year that I started with her in 1989, she had then taken an offer at Wesleyan University. So I was only able to study directly with her for 1 year, but she was so devoted and she's such an incredible mentor that she remained with me and was able to guide my dissertation, even though she wasn't a faculty member by the time I finished. So I learned a tremendous amount from her, both in the classroom and the individual meetings that we had. And I would say she really taught me how to be an ethnographer. She really taught me how to ask questions to sort of situate myself in different perspectives. The other influential classes I had, I remember that a lot of my ethnomusicology colleagues, well, when I was there, it was a degree in musicology with an emphasis in ethnomusicology. So I took both ethnomusicology and musicology classes. But one of the courses you had to take was Robert Bailey's Post-Wagnerian Symphonists class. And I remember the way in which he taught chromatic harmony through looking at Wagner and looking at Brahms and Bruckner, just opened my world to what chromatic harmony was. And I had a fairly good music theory background to really see his innovations and his perspectives in it. And that's something that really remained with me. Also, the medieval professor there was Edward Rosner, and I spent a lot of time with him. And I would say that it's my experience academically of learning about Gregorian chant that I wanted to apply to Jewish music, to the Jewish experiences that I had. So when I walked into NYU in 1989, Kay Chalamet had completed her team fieldwork project on Syrian Jews and was writing her book, The Jasmine Rained Down. And we discussed many different dissertation topics. And she and others really encouraged me to really look into the Syrian community when I was living in proximity to the community. And I remember the first time I walked into a Syrian synagogue at Congregation Kol Yisrael, and it was so confusing for me to understand where they were in the prayers. They have a different pronunciation of Hebrew. There are different minhagim, different things that they do. So starting from that perspective to writing a dissertation on it was really, to me, the incredible part of the journey. Not only loved the learning of that, for like a year and a half, I went every Shabbat, every holiday to the synagogue, and seeing how families are together and how they're navigating things. I mean, one of the things that really struck me in the Sephardic world is that if your father has an aliyah, saying blessings before the Torah, then the children stand up at that time. And there's this real sense of kavod or respect that they give in that way, and the way that they do, the priestly benediction, Birkat HaKohanim, they do it every day. In the Ashkenazic tradition, we only do it during the Shlosh Regalim and high holidays. But just seeing their love for their tradition and how important it was for them to have a community and to be together. I mean, I really felt that I had a responsibility to really convey that. But in addition to sort of conveying that, and I don't know that you can ever be truly objective. I mean, I can talk about things from different perspectives and try and incorporate different approaches. But for me, I really felt that the community really defied a lot of things that happened in the Ashkenazic community. And I was always saying, the men that I studied with to learn the Syrian tradition were about the age of my grandfather. And was thinking about my grandparents' journeys versus their journeys. And what I found from these men who I studied with, in terms of their desire to really be devoted to the community, to, it's like their passion is just their volunteerism to teach, to pray, to teach other people how to pray. And I was just so moved to see that.
Tell me a little bit about your first job at Hebrew Union College.
Oh, sure. So at Hebrew Union College, when I started, it was a time period where they had an accreditation review in the early 90s, and a flag rose that they didn't have anyone with a doctorate working in the School of Sacred Music. So they knew they had to hire someone with a PhD. At the time, I was finishing my PhD, but it was really very interesting because they really didn't know what I would teach. They just knew that they needed someone. So we experimented with a few things, and I was really grateful to my colleagues, Professor Israel Goldstein of blessed memory, and to Benji Allen Schiller, who were just very patient with me, thinking about, well, why don't you try this and why don't you try this? And then I began by teaching a course on the history of the Canaanite. And it was really a very interesting experience for me because in Israel, they learned with Eliyahu Schleifer, just an incredible Jewish musicologist and historian and cantor, about Jewish music from the Bible to basically Hasidism. And I was supposed to take it from the Enlightenment to the present time. And I knew a little bit about the history of synagogue music, but it's not like, I took comprehensives, in graduate school on this. So I really had to immerse myself in really learning this and using my skills to do it. So one of the amazing things that Hebrew Union College has is the Edward Birnbaum collection, which is one of the largest repositories of European Jewish liturgical music. And I would find different ways to get to Cincinnati or copy materials and use it to really learn that collection so that I could share that experience with my students. And I was really lucky that I had a lot of opportunities to write articles, and people who asked me to write articles for encyclopedias or different things on Jewish music, that I had that real great experience of the things that I was learning. I got to teach, I got to write about it, and then, occasionally have my writings, which I sort of felt were covering gaps in what wasn't available. So I felt that this curriculum of the history of the Canaanite sort of became, my topic to really make that contribution. And then At the time, they wanted the students, in order to get their master's theses, to have a written master's thesis and then a performance. And there wasn't a real structure to that. So a lot of my job was to provide a structure to that and really be involved in every student's experience. And it's an amazing thing to really sit with very motivated young people who you don't have to motivate them to be involved in this. You just have to send them down the path that they feel that they want to go down. And I learned a tremendous amount in that process. It's so interesting now when I go to American Conference of Cantor conventions and I see former students from, and I can't even believe I'm saying this, 20, 25, almost 30 years ago. And I remember the students by their thesis topics. And I remember their names, remember who they are. But it's like that was a lot of my investment of time with them was developing a relationship and getting them excited about the process and what they were doing. And that opened me up to so many other things. And I just feel so lucky that I really grew with the job. And I was very frustrated in the beginning that it really wasn't that structured. And then they changed the curriculum about 6, 7 years into the program, where the modal theory that Eliyahu Schleifer taught, he couldn't teach it. So then I got to teach the modal theory, and I remember, since I knew Macomb theory so well, that I just adapted Macomb theory to apply it to Jewish, the Jewish prayer modes. And we then integrated the learning of liturgy and the learning of modes together. So I co-taught with a number of other colleagues so they could learn the liturgy and learn the theory behind it at the same time. And I just love doing that.
And since you left Hebrew Union College, that position has been occupied by another musicologist. So you were really setting a standard there for what the program would rely on in terms of receiving that musicological and music theory education. So very fascinating. What kinds of advice would you offer to prospective students or new scholars who are thinking about studying Jewish music of some kind today?
I think the advice that I would first give them, I do talk to a lot of students every year. I say to them, you really have to be motivated and really have a real thirst or hunger, desire to really do this because it's not quite clear what the career path is going to be. It's not really quite clear what a doctorate in musicology or ethnomusicology with an emphasis or doing it through Jewish music, what that's going to lead to. So happy for you that you came in and had a strong desire to research a topic and have been so devoted and have done so well. But sadly, there just aren't that many positions that are available. And it's something that I think about a lot in terms of how we can try and open up more positions or more opportunities in different ways. So that's one thing, is that I want students to know that it's their motivation what's really going to, get them through. And then the second thing is to really choose a topic that they love, to really experiment. I think if students have a strong idea before they start, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But just to find where your passion is and to be open to it, and to then just follow the direction that the research takes you. I think we all know, and others on your podcast have said this, that you start with one set of research questions, and as you get into the experience, you move into something else. You grow with it. So I think that there's the sense of really being, very open-minded. I think that one needs to approach Jewish music, not unlike other topics, but I think specific to Jewish music, I feel very strongly that you have to know both the history and the culture. So that's why I'm devoted to being, a musicologist and an ethnomusicologist. I mean, I don't really make a clear distinction unless I have to. But I think that that's very important because there's a history in the Jewish tradition. Sometimes the history is not very clear, but we have to acknowledge the importance of history. And then understanding what the cultural and the contextual parameters are. And it's not only understanding what those kind of local influences are, but just having a broader sense of the context that the Jews are really working in. So it's really having a broad and open mind and finding ways in which to express what you know. And I think that I was just fortunate that I had opportunities through AJS, the Association for Jewish Studies, to really work in history panels, anthropology panels, And music panels, we're mostly talking to ourselves, those of us that already know each other, but it's good when we can sort of branch out. So I always feel that the research of Jewish music needs to continue to go into depth, but also needs that sense of breadth that we can put the research into different contexts.
So one other thing I'd love to ask you about is if you could just tell me how your relationship with Israeli scholarship has influenced the work that you do.
Sure. I remember as a undergrad seeing the Yuval publications in the library, and then there was a Jewish bookstore in LA that had some, and I had to have them, and so I bought them. I remember them being very expensive. And just pouring through those studies and learning about the scholarship of Amnon Shiloach and Israel Adler and Haju and Mazor and Ruth Katz, Dalia Cohen, really showed me how high-level Jewish music scholarship could really be done. Since the late 80s, I was able to be a part of the World Congress of Jewish Studies, which meets every 4 years. And I haven't gone to all of them since that period of time from the 90s on, but I've been to almost all of them. And I sort of felt like, every 4 years, I really got to check in with different scholars and to really hear their thoughts on my work, to really learn from them. Ruth Katz is, at this point, a very old woman with such a sharp and keen intellect. And I remember having incredible conversations with her. I got to know Amnon Shiloach and really meet with him and talk about his research and try and find how it connects to my research. Israel Adler was someone I got to know, and there was a conference I did on the Birnbaum Collection to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, and really seeing the incredible scholarship as a scholar, a bibliographer, is just so impressive in terms of the contribution that's really made. Oh, also the studies of Hanoch Avner, I always tell my students, Hanoch Avner articles are worth reading two, three, even four times. They're really, really dense, they're really, really rich, and they're things that I always are really come back to. I think that some of the ways in which Israeli scholarship is really developed in other academic contexts is there's more of an interest of what's done in Israel, what Jews do in Israel. They kind of like think the diaspora was until 1948. They don't really see that the diaspora is still going on. I know that they know that, but I just often feel that their scholarship doesn't always show that. So I think, we need to be continually in dialogue.
Who have been some of your biggest mentors or advocates or role models throughout your journey as a scholar? You've mentioned K. Kaufman Chalamet, but I wondered if there were others as well.
Yeah, there really are many. I mean, I would say one of my first important influences was my grandfather. When I got to know him, he was already retired and lived in Palm Springs. And my grandfather was just like always wanting to learn. And I just remember, like on a Sunday, if he came to LA, he would go into the city to like the Aristotle Society and discuss Greek philosophy. And I would just see him. I didn't really understand, what was going on. But just his unquenched desire for learning was always there. And I just always find that he's such a powerful influence in my life. In addition to Kay Chalamet, the other person who came into NYU and started teaching ethnomusicology was Adelea Rhea Schramm. She passed away in the last couple of years. And she had such a fascinating intellect, because she always talked about the conduct of inquiry. How do you ask questions? What are the levels of questions to ask? And I really learned that how you frame the questions is a very important part of what outcome you're going to have in your research. She was very, very influential to me. Also, another professor at NYU was Professor Robert Chazen, a blessed memory, who was a medieval Jewish scholar. And I took various Jewish history courses with him. And I just found him to be just a very, very encouraging. He was sort of very low key, and he never really talked much, but what he said really kind of guided you, in different ways. When I got more involved in the field, Scott Marcus now at University of California, Santa Barbara, who is really, one of the leading experts in Lacan theory, really helped me tremendously. And then, I've had a number of really wonderful experiences in Israel talking to other scholars. And, the person, top of the list is Professor Edwin Seroussi, who I'm always amazed at how much he's done, how much he knows. When I sort of share with him my findings of different things, he's very curious and wants to know more about it and helps me contextualize it. So, I mean, those have been my most significant mentors and influences.
Can you tell me about one of your most recently completed research projects related to Jewish music, why you chose it, and what has excited you most about working on it?
Well, the thing that comes top of mind is what I'm working on now, which is a paper I'm writing for you and Kay and editing the volume that you're doing. And it is almost done. And it's a project where I'm taking a quintessential song in the popular Arab music tradition into Omri, sung by, the very famous Kulthum, written by Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. And I've found three different piyutim or pizmonim that the Syrian and the Middle Eastern Jewish community in Israel have adapted to it. And I really haven't done a lot of work in the Syrian community for maybe about 10 years. And it's kind of one of those topics that you always sort of come back to because you know how much more there is to do. But I'm also going on to do other things. But I just found that listening to these Hebrew piyutim and trying to understand how it's influenced by Into Omri, that I just wish I could do that all day long. It's something that I just love to think about that the Arabic says this or sounds like this, and the Hebrew is very close to that, and that's certainly not by accident. And what that intimacy that the Syrian Middle Eastern Jews have with Arab music. I just find it to be fascinating. It's something that has been a part of Middle Eastern Jewish life for many centuries. And although we have sadly live in an age where Arab and Jewish interactions are so difficult with the wars and the tensions, there's such a shared culture and such a beauty to that shared culture. And it's just fascinating just to see it and try and understand it.
And from my side, I can say I'm looking forward to reading your paper. So you've hinted at some of this already, but I wondered if you could talk to me a little bit about the methodological models or tools that you most often use when you're doing your research. How and why did you develop your appreciation for these?
Sure. So I would say that something I always come back to is the semiotic approach of Nattier of trying to understand the sort of triangular structure between what the item is that you're looking at or community you're looking at, how the insiders to it explain it, and then how you observe it. And realizing that what you create is something in the middle that's a negotiated space between what others are saying about it, what you observe about it, and then what you understand about it. And I now teach the first year graduate and ethnomusicology students at UCLA, I teach the ethnography class. And that's the perspective that I take. And I think that that's the perspective that I learned from Kay Chalamet and Adelaide Arya-Schram. And I just found it to be such a useful tool just to really try and understand that you have to find different perspectives. You really have to find this incredible, negotiated space. And, I always turn to writings of Geertz in terms of religion as a cultural system, art as a cultural system, the Balinese cockfight article in Local Knowledge. And I just find that that level of inquiry was just really so fascinating, to me. On another level of research, when I'm doing more detailed music analysis, I have always been interested, and I think this is one of the unquenched things that motivated me to really go to graduate school, is try to understand the connection between the history of music of the synagogue and music of the church, or music of the temple and music of the church. And I soon realized that one needs to have a doctorate in probably five different fields in order to do that topic right, in many different ways. And it was so interesting that I would also say that the things that Idelsohn and Werner have done are really interesting. We have to challenge a lot of things that they do, but they opened a lot of doors, but we have to rethink some of their paradigms. But to be at Hebrew Union College and work into the institution that the great people who I studied just say, that's just one of those, like, you grow up and you want to play for the LA Dodgers, and then you get to do that. I mean, it's to me, it's like, on that level. But I think that looking at the analytical methodology of chant in terms of looking at oral history and fragments and the things that Willie Appel did, or Willie Apple, and Leo Treitler, Peter Jeffries, and the work that they all did in chant to try and find the orality that they feel existed in the written chant, I always find motivations in looking at that and trying to understand that orality is so significant in the transmission of music, and trying to understand the pieces of that is really important. And I did some of that in my book. I wished I would have been able to do more, trying to understand how an Arabic song or some originating melody was then developed, and different people have different interpretations of it, and just to try and understand what the aesthetic is by trying to put all that together. So those are the models that I've found useful that I want to contribute to.
I'd really love it if you could tell me a little bit more about how you moved from your undergraduate research topic of doing this comparative theoretical project, analyzing Tamim, analyzing the intricacies of how synagogue music works, to doing this much more ethnographic project during graduate school. Can you just talk me through a little bit of how you moved between these projects?
For me, ethnomusicology was something I really only learned about in graduate school. I don't even know if I knew what that was as an undergrad. It wasn't represented where I was at Cal State University Northridge. I know now it is, but at the time it wasn't. And finding out that there are new ways to look at things through ethnomusicology, I was searching for new ways, and I found this to be really very, very interesting on top of what I was sort of guided to in chant scholarship. I also was motivated by something that I always find very interesting, and that is that when we moved to New York, my wife worked for YIVO, the Jewish Intellectual Yiddish Institute. And when we came in the late 80s, there were still a lot of the European-born people who are part of YIVO in America that really helped build the archives who were there. And every time you're there, every time I went to see my wife and talk to people, everyone says at YIVO it's a levaya for Yiddish, meaning that you're always bemoaning the fact that, Yiddish had died. And then, I think that the Klezmer revival, which we were sort of a part of through YIVO at that time, was the sponsor of Klez Camp, and my wife went up as an administrator, and then I came along as well to do some teaching. Really fortunate with Henry Sapoznik's influence to be able to do that. And I just saw all these people there pining for some form of a past that was destroyed that they really want to recapture. And there was a part of me that said, in my religious life, I see the vibrant Jewish culture every single day, virtually every single minute. And I really see that and experience that through music. And so that desire to really be a part of a living community and to do the ethnographic experience, it takes something that's really not your own. So I feel with the Syrian community that I use the term by Laila Abulagad that, I'm a Hafi. Hafi, in my case, is that I'm Jewish. I understand, the prayers, or learning to understand the prayers. And on the other side, I'm not Syrian. And So there was a way in which we could dialogue in a very interesting way, but a lot of the things that, I would ask them about why they sing this prayer and not that prayer, I realized, how ethnocentric I am. Just because Ashkenazim sing a prayer this way doesn't mean everyone has to do it. And it was just so in front of me as to how the questions really have to come from a different place and really from the material. So for me, the desire to learn about the Syrian community really came from the fact that Kay Shelmake could introduce me to the leaders, and she did. We arranged a meeting where we drove to Deal, New Jersey to meet Mo Tawil, and to meet the leaders of the Syrian community through Kay was like something that might take me a really, really long time to do on my own. So I sort of felt that there was just a strong desire that I had to get through graduate school as quickly as possible and start earning money. And so I was looking for things that would be meaningful that could work out efficiently. And this is what, what happened. And I just feel that I've learned so many things from that experience that I carry with me to today.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would describe learning an entire new culture and community to be efficient, but nonetheless, I think it's really incredible that you were willing to take that leap into something you really knew not much about when you started. Many scholars will celebrate the opportunity to teach others as an extension of their own research pursuits. Can you tell me a little bit more about your recent lecturing or teaching and how you feel like it's contributed to your research agenda?
Sure. The thing that comes to mind recently is an extraordinary experience I had this summer where I got to teach at the LEMOOD program in Australia and in New Zealand. And it was really thrilling to me just to see such a vibrant Jewish community that's in Australia, and for people who have jobs and life and families and work, take a couple of days out of their life and just devote themselves, to Jewish learning. And largely the classes that I taught there were things that, I've taught many times. And I think teaching about American Jewish music through like the Yiddish influence in American pop music or things I taught on Yiddish theater, to talk about the American experience outside of America, I mean, still with an Anglo community in Australia, was really quite interesting to me because people really asked different questions and they looked at things differently. I mean, in some ways, I was amazed at how much Australians know about American culture, and I know very, very little about Australian or certainly New Zealand culture. But, I mean, many New Zealanders are transplants from other places, but the whole aspect of really teaching about American Jewish music in another context was really interesting. And in the New Zealand LEMOOD, I taught a class on Shabbat about the rabbinic ban on music and how that is formulated in Mishnayot and Halakha, and that what the various understandings of it are. And I wrote an article on this, but it never got published. And so it's something that kind of gave me the impetus to return to it. But I won't return to it until after I write the article for you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, if you're already thinking about it, you should probably pivot and go write that other article you never got out the door. But yeah, finish the one for me first, as they say. Are there other kinds of new research questions or subjects currently preoccupying you? I know for a moment, a couple of years ago, you were thinking about Orthodox men's popular music performance. Is that still a direction you think you're going to head?
That's been a topic with me since I started graduate school in 1989 with my first urban ethnomusicology class with Kay Shelmay, and I am still actively working on that, and I hope in a couple of years that my book on that will be done. And that topic for me represents a lot of different things. So much of my experience in Brooklyn of not growing up Orthodox, of being a Baal Tshuva, of really not experiencing New York Jewish culture till I was an adult, that all sort of comes together. And I found it to be very interesting that while I was living on the East Coast, I just found it really difficult to really put my mind into the topic, and largely because of the insider-outsider perspectives on it. And then when I moved to LA, I think 2 or 3 years in, I had a trip to New York for a conference and spent Shabbat in Flatbush. And I had a whole new understanding of what Flatbush was in terms of, its intensity and how people sort of feel that their connection to Judaism needs to develop intellectually, constantly, by ideas that they're looking at, by questioning practices, by just being current on different things that people are thinking about. And I'm sure that intensity exists in Los Angeles and many other cities, but I don't think it exists like it does, in Brooklyn. And that helped me realize what sort of the thesis of the book is about, is that, the music of the Orthodox life is really about that intensity. It's about that experience. And so writing about that is just a wonderful experience. I mean, some of the other things that I hope to write after that is that, being director of the Lowell Milken Center for Music and American Jewish Experience has really led me to, understand how much there is to do in terms of trying to understand American Jewish music. Or we can't posit that that necessarily exists. That's, of course, one of the questions, but how Jews in America are expressing themselves musically. That's something that I just think there are so many things to do, and a lot of the research projects I'm doing are a part of it. Conferences I'm developing are a part of that, and I just think that there's a great frontier there.
So there are a couple of questions that I typically ask all my participants on this podcast. A couple of sets of questions, I should say. And the first set is how you understand the field of Jewish music. What issues or challenges with this field of study do you think scholars today need to remain attentive to?
So I feel the field of Jewish music that I'm very actively trying to build with all the resources that I have is to broaden and deepen. We need to have more in-depth studies. There are so many incredible in-depth studies in music in Israel that are published by Yuval and the Jewish Music Research Center, and they provide a wonderful model of, that level of detail and recordings and annotations and understanding of the recorded traditions. So that's something that I think really needs to be done more broadly. But we need those deepened studies. And then the broadening level, we need to really see how Jews are a part of other forms of culture making, of expression, that concerts of Jewish music are great, but a concert of music, whatever it may be, chamber, orchestral, different heritage forms of music, if it has many different traditions, including Jewish music, I sort of feel my desire is, I want Jewish music to have a seat at the table. I want it, I hope that the work that I do will be to embed Jewish music, not only into different things at UCLA because of our endowments, but also within the academic societies that we can foster this community of dialogue. And I think we need to always continue to dialogue with each other and build the community and the networks that are established there, and also have the conversations with our colleagues in other fields, in the hope that Jewish music doesn't have to be what people often see it is, which is a specialty within a specialty. It's really quite interesting how a lot of Jewish studies departments sort of, some include music, most don't. The fact that you're a part of one is really incredible. And it's really about, a testament to the work that you do, that it's not only a statement about music, but it's also a statement on Jewish history and Jewish culture. And those are conversations that we really need to have. I had always thought in the 90s, when I was clear to me that my career was in New York, that the incredible mentors and people that I knew, such as Kay Shelamy, Mark Slobin, Phil Bowman, Ellen Koskoff, that when I talked to them, they all said that they believe that they're an ethnomusicologist or musicologist first, an area study scholar second, and Jewish music comes third or fourth down the list. And at that time, I had the great opportunity being in college to just devote myself to Jewish music. And I just felt, I was really working like in the Jewish studies environment, that I didn't see Jewish music as something that needs to work in that paradigm. The paradigm that I wanted was that it needs to be put into Jewish studies. And I remember in all my conversations with Edwin Seroussi, I mean, he like really put that out there, that that's what, and he's written about that, and he advocates for that, that's what needs to happen in America. There needs to be that level of integration of looking at it. So I think that the things that Judah Cohen and Jim Leffler and I were able to do with the Jewish Music Forum that you and Gordon Dale are continuing, I really feel sort of came out of that spirit where we really try to have someone talk about their research and get someone who was in Jewish studies, if it was a musical topic, to comment on it and see it. And likewise, if someone was doing Jewish music from as a historian, to have a music scholar come and be a part of that. So that type of dialoguing needs to continue to happen. And I think we've been able to make some inroads at the Association of Jewish Studies. I don't think we've done enough with that. We need to do a lot more. And then we need to do that in our, respective other fields of music study in the larger academy. I mean, just the fact that we now have special interest groups of Jewish music at the American Musicological Society, the Society for Ethnomusicology, and the Society for American Music is just a great start, and we just need to keep those things going.
Yes, I'm with you on that. The final set of questions that I like to ask all my participants are as if they believe that there's such a thing at all as Jewish music or an identifiable Jewish sound.
Well, since I have an endowed chair, yeah, Mickey Katz endowed chair in Jewish music, I'd like to think there is, and I sort of go with that assumption. But I realize that when you ask that question of what is Jewish music, it's a highly essentialized question that you feel really has an answer. I think the answer is far more complicated. I would say that Jewish music is contextually defined. Jewish music is defined within the context. I mean, clearly, the great Cantorit from 1880s to the 1930s is a clear form of Jewish music. Klezmer music during that era, Yiddish theater music during that era are all part of those specific genres. But really, within each of those contexts, there are many different influences. And I always think about the fact that in America, 80 to 85% of American Jews have their history from Eastern Europe. And Sephardim are really in the minority. Although they're very vibrant and very active communities, they're just smaller. Where in Israel, it's almost flipped, where over 50% of Israel is the Mizrahi identity. And for them, music works very differently. I don't know that they would say that the form of Middle Eastern Jewish music has to sound a particular way. It's really just the context in which that they're working in, and they're very flexible, the music that they take, and then how it might be codified in a book of Pizmonim or Piyutim sort of becomes the context. But I think the fact that it's so dynamic and it's always changing is very much a part of it. And that's something that I find like in the Orthodox music. I mean, we might think that the Orthodox community, which tries to isolate itself, is sort of very protective of things. And there are forms of that, but then there's also ways in which they do things in ways that just constantly surprise me. My older sister Zubavitch, when I've gone to the weddings of my nieces and nephews that are in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, when like the second or third dance set is some of the, yeshiva or Hasidic melodies, but done in an EDM style. It's just a whole different generational approach as to what Jewish music is. I mean, the thing that I think about in terms of the Jewish music that I listen to, that I get motivated by, is music for me that somehow synthesizes East and West and the past and the present. And I think that that's ultimately what the challenge is in studying and creating Jewish music, is that tradition and innovation are always at play. And then there are always these very broad cultural entities that come into play. And things that that mix that up in different ways, I just find to be so satisfying.
That is such a phenomenal answer. So I think we believe things there for today, but I wanted to thank you so much again for your willingness to speak with me. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm looking forward to continuing to be in dialogue with you.
Oh, for sure. Thank you so much for doing this, Samantha. What you're doing is incredible.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish Podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA, and the University of Kansas Program in Jewish Studies. Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Halina Goldberg to discuss her ongoing study of Polish Jewish music.